Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Kate Christensen, whose latest novel is Trouble. Earlier novels include The Great Man, Jeremy Thrain, In the Drink, The Epicure's Lament. The strength of Trouble, one of its strengths, is the voice of the narrator, Josie. And I understand that when your books begin, the way you start your books, except for The Great Man, which was written in third person, is generally by hearing a voice, the voice of the character. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. It's more than hearing a voice. I almost become haunted the way a house is haunted by a ghost. My skull gets haunted by a character, and it rattles around up there and starts talking. And once he or she begins to speak, then it takes shape in language so the story can begin. But the first thing I get is sort of an imprint of who this person is and a bit of what kind of trouble he or she is in, because this is the first time I've actually called a novel Trouble. But it's literally the thing that interests me the most is sort of interpersonal and personal trouble.
The book itself, I understand that the idea came to you when you were in Mexico City finishing The Great Man in February 2006. What exactly happened?
I was staying in the hotel where Josie and Raquel stay in Mexico City, the Hotel Isabel, and it's in the colonial center of the city, and it's a great hotel. You can get a really beautiful room for $30. There's one room that has five beds in it that my friend stayed in when he came down to meet me down there. And it's one of those legendary hotels. And I always have real places in my novels. The house in The Great Man actually exists. It's a house that my ex-husband and I bought about 7 years ago, and I used it for the novel. My next novel is called The Astral, which is an apartment building in Greenpoint. And anyway, the idea for Trouble came to me as a sense of place and a sense of these two women fleeing something. I didn't know what yet. These two friends in their mid-40s, Josie and Raquel. And I thought, I need to have them come down to Mexico City. I love Mexico City. And I was finishing The Great Man, which, as you said, is in the third person. And it's the hardest thing I ever wrote. I felt like I needed a break. I wanted to write something that would just write itself. And I just felt this voice of Josie as a kind of propulsive flow, and sort of envisioned her narrative as a kind of nonstop just stream of events over a very short amount of time.
I understand the other side of it is that you had some painful misunderstanding with one of your own best friends.
That's right, and I dedicated it to her. It's Kathy Hanauer. We did have a painful misunderstanding a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, and it took a long time to get through it, and I largely owe it to her dedication and loyalty to our friendship that we did get through it. And it made me think a lot about female friendship, and this novel sort of addresses the idea. It's, for me, a novel about female friendship.
Well, what's the difference then? I mean, I was reading this and seeing friends, and I have friends, and, you know, there's a quote in an interview that appears online where you talk about this no commitment ceremonies, there's no friendship therapy for female friends. I was thinking, wait a second, I have male friends. We have the same problems. Is there something here that's specific to women then?
No, and I say female friendship because that's the only kind I know, because I'm right. Obviously I'm a woman. So But I often amend it lately when I'm asked about it to include men and say, yeah, I'm sure male friendship is exactly the same. It goes very deep. It's very intense often, and you choose each other. It's not, you know, you choose each other every time you have coffee. You make a choice to sustain the friendship. But there's nothing binding.
You know, if there's a marriage, you do something about it. But if something comes up with friends, you do nothing. There's nothing you can do.
It's almost as if by doing nothing, you're not choosing the friendship. It's such an active thing, friendship, in a way that marriage isn't. And the disparity between marriage and friendship is something that I wrote about in this book and had kind of fun with, I think. The idea that a marriage can die, but you have to end it, and it's a big deal to end it, whereas a friendship, when there's a rift, as there is between Josie and her friend Indrani, you don't say anything, you don't do anything, and it sort of heals itself at the end of the book without having to say a word about it, whereas marriage is all about therapy and working on your relationship and, you know, living together, I guess.
Well, I guess it would not just be marriage, but all relationships that are, quote, relationships would fall into that category.
Exactly.
But the other part of it, of course, is that, you know, with your family and your siblings, you're also tied. That will never go. It can't go. But the friend can come and go instantly. It's very strange.
It is. It's like no other relationship. Because family, like, well, I would include, you're right, not just marriage, but living with a partner, that has a kind of commitment. That has an implicit sort of binding commitment that friendship doesn't have. And yet when, let's say, when my best friend Kathy is old and sick, God forbid, I'm as close to her as anyone else on the planet. And we've often talked about that, like we're as close as spouses, we're as close as sisters, but I'm not the person who will have any say in what happens to her. And it's just interesting. It doesn't have any of the rights or the obligations of other relationships.
Your relationship on some level is kind of the relationship between Josie and Indrani.
Well, you would think that, but actually Raquel is based on Kathy. And Kathy's not a rock star, per se, not literally a rock star, but she has certain rock star-ish qualities. And she looks like Raquel, so I based Raquel physically on her. But Raquel, Josie, and Indrani are all me. They're all aspects of my own psyche. They're all sort of ways that I talk to myself. Well, another thing I can say is that when I finished this book, I finished revising it in August and turned it into my editor, and a month later I realized my marriage was over.
Really, by looking in a mirror?
Yeah, no. I think the novel was the mirror I was looking in.
Wow, and that happened just suddenly a month later?
Yeah, well, it had been happening gradually all summer. I knew something was wrong. I knew something wasn't working in my life, and I was in a panic. I was sort of like a live wire sparking around. And I was drinking like a fish and sort of not stable in my mind at all, and I didn't know what it was.
The odd thing here is that you're basically reciting Josie in Mexico City.
Right.
So you were in a sense writing yourself without necessarily knowing you were writing yourself?
So odd. Because Josie is not me. I mean, I'm very different from her. And I deliberately chose a first-person narrator who was different from me. And the one I relate to the most is Raquel. And the voice that would have been the most sort of natural for me to take on was hers. She's self-aware and cynical and awake.
Let's get into this a little later, because it's kind of interesting talking about the nature of fiction and how fiction relates to people on so many different levels when you're writing it, let alone when you're reading it. But let's go back to this friendship between these three women. They went to college together, and they've stayed in touch even though they've gone their own ways. And the book opens with Josie looking into a mirror, realizing that the woman that she sees in the mirror is not the woman she thinks she is, and she goes, wait a second, my marriage is over.
That's right.
And then her friend Raquel, who's a rock star, based on anybody that you can think of?
She's a composite of friends of mine and also real-life rock stars. Well, there's Kathy Hanauer, and then there's my friend Janice Sloan, who lived in Mexico for a long time and is an artist. They both have rock starish qualities, even though they're an artist and a writer. But then Cat Power and PJ Harvey were the two women I was sort of thinking of when I thought of Raquel, sort of that style of musician.
Raquel calls out of the blue. She lives in L.A. She's in her mid-40s. Her career has kind of moved into classic status. She's trying to hold on. And then the gossip bloggers, the TMZs, fictional TMZs.
Perez Hilton.
find out that she's been sleeping with a younger man who's gotten his girlfriend pregnant. And they come down hard on her, and she needs to go away. She goes to Mexico City and says, Josie, come down here. The rest of the book is their adventures in Mexico City. At that point, when you realized Raquel, how did the story of the bloggers and her escape come about to you? Did it just write itself?
That did write itself, but I was obsessed with gossip bloggers for about a year before I started Trouble, and it was something like potato chips for me. I would check every day. I would make the rounds of Perez Hilton and TMZ and a couple of other ones, and I was just riveted, and I was riveted by what women, mostly women, and in some cases gay men, say about aging female stars. And the cruelty, it's a double-edged coin. It's obsession, but it's also cruelty. And the sort of mercilessness of the bloggers. And I thought about what it must be like. I found myself empathizing with these women like Courtney Love and Pambo, as she's called, and Posh Spice, and just sort of women who have the temerity to get older and who are aging really well with a lot of intervention, surgical and otherwise.
The other day I was in a supermarket and I noticed that the Globe and the Examiner and the Enquirer, all of them have pictures of aging stars that are deliberately made to look bad.
Right. Right. And it's sort of like a betrayal of our pact with these stars. Like, you will not age. You will not age is sort of, and they are blowing their end of it. It's like these tabloids are punishing them. I saw a picture of Robin Penn Wright, who's one of the most beautiful women. There were two contrasting pictures, before she left Sean or before she and Sean broke up and after they got back together. And it said, she should have stayed away from him. Look how terrible she looks now that they're back together. She looked like she was just maybe out without makeup on. She looked like a gorgeous woman. What are our standards? What's going on here?
The other side of it is obsession that people seem to have despite themselves that comes up when Michael Jackson dies.
Right.
When that happened, did you immediately flash on Trouble?
Absolutely. Yeah, the ghoulishness and the sort of the way that his career has suddenly revived itself because of his death. You know, he was going to have this big comeback, and now he doesn't have to. The irony did not escape me. There's something about putting a lid on somebody that makes them larger than life all of a sudden, now that they're gone. You see them really... Artists are seen very differently after they die. I think that's really interesting. Artists of any kind, writers too.
How do you look at some of these ideas in Trouble and relate them to the ideas in The Great Man, the artist there? Do you see any kind of movement between those two books then?
I actually think Trouble is sort of an outgrowth on the head of The Great Man in terms of feeling my way through my books and seeing where they all come from. I think Trouble is just sort of it's like a little baby being born out of the head of that novel. You know, like Athena came from Zeus. Definitely, I think there's a connection because I think both novels are sort of exploring the difference between public and private lives, which is something that I'm obsessed with. And I see you have Jeremy Thrain there, which is also about that. And I'm so interested in fame in personal terms, not so much stardom, but more what it does to people and how people react to their own legends and how they become trapped and calcified.
We get this idea, Kate Christensen, that the idea is to be famous, but then if you're famous, you're accosted walking down the street. Raquel has to run away from it because she's in the center of it. She can't be herself.
Right.
And any attempt to be herself suddenly brings out the paparazzi.
Well, yeah, and that's something else that the whole novel is sort of looking at from various sides is judgment and how we judge one another and how women, even friends, judge each other, where that judgment comes from, what sort of fears give rise to this, you know, this bloggerazzi pillorying of Raquel for sleeping with this younger man. Of course, it's her fault, not his, even though he's the one with the pregnant girlfriend.
Is this something that is mostly American or English language? I mean, it seems to have started in Britain and then just took off here.
I wonder if it's puritanical in some way, if England and America are both fairly puritanical cultures. I don't know if it exists in Australia to quite this extent, and Australia is a country that's founded by prisoners. I wanted to say one thing about this country, which is that I think we're a very adolescent country. I think that we have an obsession with youth and purity and sort of pregnant women and, you know, that on the one side, and then on the other side, there are women who age, women who have inappropriate love affairs, women who say or do the wrong things. And it's an obsession with women in some way, an obsession with the behavior of women.
My mother said that to me after watching what happened to Martha Stewart, after watching what happened to Leona Helmsley. These people, the Leona Helmsleys and the Martha Stewarts, are no better or worse than a lot of men, but suddenly they get thrown into prison.
Yeah, women are held to higher standards.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, in the book, Josie and Raquel talk about this in their room in Mexico City at the Isabel, and they say, well, we're expected to be better than men, maybe because we are better than men. The world without men is Little Women. The world without women is Lord of the Flies.
Do you believe that?
I don't know what I believe. I mean, my characters spout all kinds of things, and it entertains me to have them have these opinions. But honestly, I don't think women are better than men. I don't think I'm any better than anybody.
You're listening to an interview with Kate Christensen, whose latest novel is Trouble. Why did you make Josie a psychologist?
Because I, again, was playing with this idea of public versus private, and I liked the idea of a shrink on vacation. My mother's a therapist, and I've been privy over the years to a lot of stories about her clients that are riveting, and especially to a novelist, fascinating. I also have been, like many New Yorkers, in therapy for years, a variety of therapists. I think it's required when you live there. So I've had opportunity to observe therapy at close hand, personally. And I always think about, like, what do shrinks do between clients? What do they think about what's going on in their personal life? What do they do on vacation? Shrinks always take vacations, and it's always supposed to be traumatic for the client. And they never really talk about what they did and where they went. And it's like, I feel like the way my dog must feel when I come back from a trip and he sniffs me to find out where I've been. It's just a mystery. It's like, and so I wanted to delve into that mystery about how shrinks are no smarter or more perceptive than the average person when they're not in their office.
Did you actually talk to some psychologists to find out what they did do?
No, I didn't. I made it all up because I'm a novelist. And that's what I get to do.
But you were very clear on not making up Mexico City.
That's right. And I rarely make up places. Even the house in the Epicure's Lament exists in every particular. The crazy mansion that Hugo lives in on the Hudson River is an actual place, and I went there and took notes and described it. I make up people, but I don't make up places.
Is there really a hotel with bird cages that people can't get into unless they get a drink in the
yes.
bar?
Yes. Every single place I wrote about exists.
The place where Raquel gets up and sings with her friend Chewy?
That place exists, Pata Negra.
And the art galleries?
The art gallery is in every particular real place, where my friend Janice had a show. And I went, and the entire art world of Mexico City was there, and I was impressed. And she said, no, the entire art world of Mexico City goes to every single opening.
And there's also a character who turns out to be gay, and Josie the psychologist doesn't get it.
There you go. That's exactly what I was doing. She doesn't get anything. She doesn't observe anything correctly. She gets out of New York where she knows the score and she's sort of at home and can look at people and know exactly what's going on. But even in the opening scene, she's caught in a lie with a man she's flirting with. So she's a little daft. She's a little smug and a little daft. And there's a certain type of person who really exists. And I was basing her on my observations of people that I've met at parties and talked to, and just this sort of idea that you know everything because you live in New York and it's the center of the world. And then you go somewhere like Mexico City, which is so different and so complex. And her observations of people, I think they were, to me, very ironic.
Kate Christensen, there's a review I read in the LA Times which talked about Josie's shortcomings, that she doesn't think about her crumbling marriage and her daughter when she's there. And then it suddenly occurred to me that, in point of fact, she didn't even think about her friend Raquel much.
Right.
Everything was totally ego-centered.
Right.
And toward the end of the book, when she goes off with Philippe and says, hey, Raquel, are you going to be okay? And I'm thinking, no, she's
right.
not going to be okay.
In no way is she going to be okay. Josie is monumentally selfish, but that's the book I set out to write. I hate it when reviewers tell me what I should have written.
We have here not the unreliable narrator, but the narrator who turns out to be completely self-involved so that we actually see more than the narrator
that
sees.
That was the idea. It's first person limited.
There's a book out called Shanghai Girls,
yes.
where Lisa C. actually does the same thing.
I want to read it.
It's different, but at the same time, we have a first person narrator who tells everything, but she only sees half the picture.
That's just like Josie. It's the same idea. It's the same idea. And the idea for me was that it was so easy for her. That's about a certain kind of truth that I think isn't written about much, that women don't have to be punished for changing their lives. I mean, I think a couple of reviewers wanted me to be harder on her and have worse things happen to her. But her trajectory is opposite from Raquel's. And my image of the book was of these two very different trajectories of two friends who are together, and one friend doesn't see what's happening.
By the end of it, we shouldn't be sympathizing with Josie. We could sympathize with her because she started out her new life, but on the other hand, a lot of the complaints that Indrani makes about her, or even Raquel, are right.
That's right. And her friends know her very well. They know her better than she knows herself, which is often the case with friendship.
Kate Christensen, and going onto your website, I noticed a page devoted to recipes. What's that about?
Okay, here's what that's about. My publisher put together this website, and my publicist at the time, who was also a good friend of mine, thought it would be a good idea for me to write out the recipes from the great man. And I had invented them all on the page. I had cooked none of them. So I spent a summer giving dinner parties, using my friends as guinea pigs, and figuring out what the recipes were, and wrote them down. It's the first time I've actually written down my recipes. Normally, I just sort of cook improvisationally, which is also the way I write. coincidentally or not.
Well, I was thinking of maybe going back to it and testing a couple of them if they didn't require too much effort.
They don't. They're pretty easy. And you know what? I have a fan club. I actually have a fan club in Seattle who cooked their way through those recipes. So they did it for you. And apparently the chickpea salad is very good.
The great man focuses around older women in their 70s and their sexuality. How was it for you putting yourself inside someone that much older than you looking back? Was that easy or hard?
It was both. It was an act of imagination, like writing The Epicure's Lament, which is or Jeremy Thrain, which is a gay man my age. It's the most autobiographical thing I've written. It was sort of myself as a gay man, which isn't that hard to envision. But older women, I'm very close to my mother, and she's now almost 73. Right before I started the book, she fell in love and had a torridly passionate love affair with someone she'd had a crush on for 30 years. And I was very inspired by that. You know, part of me was thinking, go mom, this is great. And another part of me, the writer part of me, was thinking, what must that be like? And it made me think about how older women have been portrayed in literature, which is, you know, the old biddy and the tedious auntie or the saintly old woman who gives advice or, you know, somebody whose life is behind her and isn't really alive anymore, wanting things. And I thought, you know, my mother and her friends are all kind of sexy and alive and, you know, like me, but older with more memories and, you know, more history. It was based on observations of women and a kind of desire to write the balance of older women in books.
This book, then, Trouble, kind of brings you back a little bit more to yourself, more than you realized at the time, I guess.
So ironic, I know.
But let's get back to that thing we were talking about before, about the relation of fiction. When you look back at The Great Man or Jeremy Thrain, let's say, or Epicure's Lament, afterward, do you see things in those books which mirror things in your own life that you didn't know about at the time?
Oh, yeah. Every single book. I mean, this one is the most dramatically related to my own life and the most closely temporally related. I mean, leaving my husband right after I hand in the final draft, I think that's a little telling of something. My unconscious is more perspicacious than I thought.
Was he as surprised as, or not surprised as Anthony?
He's very different from Anthony. My marriage is completely different from Josie's, and so, of course, it had a very different ending. And I, unlike Josie, did not go down to Mexico City. I stayed, and we spent the winter really talking about what had happened, you know, hoping to remain the closest of friends and hoping to come to some kind of mutual understanding about, you know, why I had to leave.
Did you?
I hope so. I really hope so. But, you know, I understand it. You never know if the other person does.
In terms of going back to these other elements, what in Jeremy Thrain resonated in you afterward?
Jeremy Thrain was written at a time, it was my second novel, and it was all the stuff that I didn't say in The Drink. I felt hampered in In The Drink by Claudia's voice, which is very breezy. And I wanted a more contemplative, internal, some might say too contemplative, that, you know, some passages really could have been cut out, that he goes on and on and on in his thoughts. But that's the thing that I didn't get to do in The Drink. And I felt like the ending of Jeremy Thrain was my meeting my husband. That's the story of, actually, almost literally, I've never based a character on him before or since. So it was really a story of my meeting him and falling in love with him.
And The Great Man, when you come at it from the third person, just from that perspective, you can't get the voice. How did you get there?
It was so hard. It was so hard. I started the book, I was pretending I was writing a first-person narrative, and I went democratically into everybody's heads, and I didn't know how to do third person. I didn't realize that I had to play God. I didn't want to be the authority. I really love letting someone else take over and narrate. And so the first draft was a huge mess. It was 300 pages, and it wasn't finished, and I sent it to my editor, who couldn't even finish reading it, and he said, "This is a mess. Whose story is this? You've got to figure it out." For me, the story isn't just one person. It's a kind of energy between all these different characters. And I really saw it almost visually as a map of spiky feelings about everybody, about each other, one another, as almost a social landscape more than a voice.
And at that point, it requires a tremendous amount more editing, I would think.
Tremendous, tremendous amount of work. Yeah, I was exhausted when I finished it. And then I wrote Trouble in 3 months for fun.
And then how did The Astral come out of your work afterward?
The Astral is going to be narrated, well, I've started it. It's narrated by a 57-year-old male poet who's walking around Greenpoint. His wife has kicked him out because he's written a lot of love sonnets to imaginary women, and she doesn't believe they're imaginary. She's a bit of a jealous freak. And they've been married for 30 years, and she's finally had enough of, you know, she's finally decided that, okay, enough of him. So again, it's about the aftermath of a marriage, but a very different one. And his voice, which I'm still trying to get, and this is sort of the process of writing these novels. I have to write about 125 pages that I then throw away, and then I can get to the real story. But that's how I get the voice.
In that process, how do you know you don't quite have the voice yet?
I think because when I read it, it doesn't yet feel authentic. It feels I can hear me straining, my own sort of striving to get the voice, and I think I'm imitating the horse's mouth right now, and I have to get away from that.
Is this something that you learned, the process that you learned when you were in Iowa?
I didn't learn a thing at Iowa.
Really?
I hated it there. I had the worst time there. I was depressed. I barely made it to workshop. I drank a lot of Jim Beam and read a lot of Wallace Stevens. I'm not kidding. I really hated it, and I hated the whole workshop process. Fine teachers, and I made great friends, and it's a very reputable place, but the weather is terrible. And sitting in a workshop with other writers is so scary. It was a nest of vipers, I felt, aside from my allies and friends who remain to this day. It really is kind of a poisonous environment for a writer. And I don't believe you learn anything at those places. I didn't really start writing until 10 years after I left, and I feel like I had to get it out of my hair or something, get all that earnest sort of MFA, you know, American writing out of my head before I could be cheeky and sly.
So you don't think any of it penetrated at all, then?
Well, it's not that it didn't penetrate. I mean, it was a huge luxury to be there. I feel like a brat for whining. You get 2 years to do nothing but write. It's fantastic. It's just that I don't think I was writing very authentically. I think I was too nervous about what people were going to make of it. At the time, it was all about Raymond Carver, and everyone was trying to be Raymond Carver, and nobody can be Raymond Carver except Raymond Carver, and everyone was very earnest and minimalist, and it's just not my style at all. But not to my credit, I was trying to write that way, the earnest coming-of-age novel that I, thank God, I jettisoned and never looked back at.
Well, what afterward, now you've written five different novels, and who are you writing for? I mean, does that even play a role? You just kind of say, screw it, and I'm going to just follow the voice?
No, I always have a muse, and each of my books has a different male muse, and they're always men, interestingly. I'm a great believer in muses, especially people that you want to – it's always someone I want to impress, someone I have a crush on.
Really?
Let's say, yeah. It spurs me and inspires me to have something to prove to someone.
Couple of quick questions. The great man, had you ever thought of Picasso in that context?
Yes. In fact, I talk about Picasso at the beginning of the book, and Teddy compares Oscar to Picasso and says, well, Picasso was catnip to women also, but he was cold. Oscar was warm and needy and soulful, and goes on from there.
So you knew exactly what you were doing at the beginning of the book.
By the time I wrote that draft, I hoped I knew what I was doing. I'd been through enough editing and and revising.
When you get onto a book like The Astral, what do you think you've learned, if anything, from having written five novels? Or, as some people say, is it still as much of a mystery on book number six as it was on book number one?
The way I conceive of book number six is that it will be as much of a challenge as any of the others. And so I don't know if I can pull it off. And this is also, in addition to having a muse, this is also the feeling I want. It's a little bit of like going on a roller coaster. I'm a little scared and excited. So I think what I've learned is just to trust that if I keep at it, something will happen. And I used to doubt that. So that's a useful thing to know.
Have you ever had any word from Hollywood on any of these books?
Oh, yeah. I don't even know if I'm allowed to say this, so I won't, but I had lunch with a movie star the other day who wants to play Josie, and she's exactly who I had in mind for Josie. And I met with her and the producer-director that she's affiliated with. And it was a surreal, exciting experience. I hope it happens. My fingers are crossed, but my breath is not held.
And on any of the others, The Great Man?
Yes, The Epicure's Lament also, the person... I also shouldn't say who, but the person I had in mind for Hugo is interested. I wrote a script. He read it. He said, you know what? I need to play Hugo. He's affiliated also with the director and producer, and she wants to make it. Again, my breath is not held. Nothing ever happens in Hollywood.
Do you have any interest in working on the screenplays?
Well, I wrote the screenplay for The Epicure's Lament. It was really fun. It was tremendously fun. I felt like I distilled the novel into bouillon and re-envisioned it. But Trouble, no, no interest at all. I'm completely done with that book. It served its purpose in my life.
One final question, Kate Christensen. In looking at a book like Trouble, does it scare you that some of the worst events in the book came true? And does it scare you in terms of writing anything in the future?
It's kind of an odd feeling. I feel like other things I've written, you asked about this and I didn't fully answer it, other things I've written have also taken place after I wrote them. I mean, small things like the heroin packet quilt in Jeremy Thrain, after I invented that quilt that his friend Felicia makes for her art opening, I actually walked into a hotel lobby and there it was. And I met the artist and he'd never read the book. I feel like novelists kind of have antenna out in the world and we're just picking up frequencies and we're not fully aware in our own lives and other people's lives. And I guess it's called the zeitgeist or something. I don't know. It's just picking up what might happen or potential things that often come true.
I've talked to some writers about that, and I kind of say, you know, is it some kind of weird thing that happens that sometimes as you're working on a book, your life starts to parallel the book and things come into your life, and they always go yes. And the other is sometimes if they don't know, for instance, a mystery, if they have no idea what the ending is going to be, suddenly they look, and it was there all the time.
Yeah. That's the most mysterious thing of all.
It kind of makes you a little bit both sane and crazy, I think, that it happens that way.
I think writers are as superstitious as primitive tribes, and there's a reason.
You've been listening to an interview with Kate Christensen, whose latest novel is Trouble. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.